3, 2, 1.
Boom! And we are on. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of The Renegade Show. And today I have someone special in the pod. He's been a mentor and a friend of mine for a long time, and I'm excited for him to be on the pod to share his experience as a wartime executive and an optimist. Welcome to the pod, Lawrence.
Hey, Kelvin. Thank you for having me. It's great to hear from you and also great to be a part of this exciting podcast.
So for our listeners here, why don't you maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
I started off working when I was just finished high school in Malaysia. And I was a hotelier at that time. For 14 years, I started as a busboy, worked myself up and became a food and beverage director in several hotels. Been in the opening team for about 6 to 7 hotels in Malaysia, all across Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, Petaling Jaya, Ipoh, Penang. After 14 years in the hotel line, I managed to come out of it and started working for American Express in the risk management department, which a lot of people will say, which is a drastic change. But I take a look at this as everything in life changes. There's always something to look forward to in anything you do. So I took a look at it at a different challenge in my working life, and I was there for almost 5 years before moving over to Gateway Computers. I don't know how many people out there listening still remember Gateway Computers. At their heyday, they were number 2 to Dell in the consumer market and also in the server market as well. At that time, when the market crashed in 2000, they downsized and went back to US. They shut down all the operations in Asia-Pac and EMEA in Europe and concentrated in America. Well, Dell took the bull by the horns and expanded, and that is why they are number one now.
So you went from food and beverage to risk management to serving a consumer product company.
Yep, that's right. Within the next few months, I got a start at Anderson Consulting, which 6 months later became Accenture, and started working for them in January 2001.
And you're part of the transition?
Part of the transition, yes, in a small way, I guess, because they were moving away from their traditional consulting into business process outsourcing, which they took a look at it. And only then also, while I was in the company, kind of realized how big business process outsourcing, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's almost coming at 70% right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a powerhouse, right, I do admire them because, you know, they've managed to rebrand. And it's not a small company. It's a really, really huge company. And they managed to rebrand and re-strategize in a very effective manner. Mm-hmm. So while in Accenture, I was a seconded to the India team, building their data center and their contact center in Bangalore. Those were exciting times. So when I came back home to Kuala Lumpur, to my team, I had to, again, transition them to India because that's where everything is being strategized. And at that moment, left Accenture. Mm-hmm. In good terms, it was a fantastic experience working at Accenture. Mm-hmm. And I joined a small Australian company called Intertouch, which provides connectivity services for hotels all around the world. Mm-hmm. At the time when I joined them, they had their vision was to move from an outsourcing unit for support services to insource. I mean, they wanted to have full control of their support and network capabilities. Mm-hmm. And I was put in charge of the Center of Excellence in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, to start up their network operations and also their consumer and business, contact center. Mm-hmm. I guess at this moment, it'll be called customer experience. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, so that one we started off very small. I had in total, I think, 18 people.
Right.
And within 8 months, I had a massive number of 350 people.
So you went from 18 to 350 mm-hmm. in 18 yep, months.
Actually 8 months.
8 months. So you you recruited, you onboarded, and you trained.
Yes,
what is
that's
that?
Right.
The compound growth within 8 months. Oh, that's huge.
That's huge. Frankly, when I think about it right now, I really don't know if I slept at all.
Yeah. So this will be a good jumping point. I think I want to kind of bring a couple of things here. One is you've had to kind of use your left brain, right brain, and switch your paradigms multiple times, right? You had to go from food and beverage to risk management to consumer product, and then now, and then management consulting to contact center or business process outsourcing, and then now effectively a startup going from 18 to 350 in 8 months. So tell me in that experience of yours, how were you able to adapt and change so quickly? And how were you dealing with those recessionary times and those constraints that were put on you?
Well, one thing though, we were still coming out of the recession at the time. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of talent around, I must say. I was lucky in that way. There's a lot of talent that was out there. And I also could tap into my former staff who were working with me in the Accenture Contact Center to come over and be a nucleus. If you're going to grow a business from 18 to 350, you need to have the right strategy. You need to have the right people. You need to have your brain switched on, because you're now effectively a general heading an army and marching forward. So you need to have a battle plan. You need to know what are your win points and what exactly are you going to give back to your company, because the whole company is looking at you for growth.
Had you been trained? Had you had that experience of compounding your recruitment that fast in that short of period of time before you had gone into touch?
Not in that volume, right? Not in that volume. I've grown businesses from 10 to 30 to 50 many times. It's not a problem. Even in Gateway, because at that time, when I first joined them, they were like 20 people. When we exited our business strategy, we had about 200 odd people at that time. Yeah, okay. So we moved from one building to another building. So I had to reopen a new setup. So that experience also helped me in doing this as well.
Right. So you had some reference point in doing this, but
yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But other than that, it was number one is. In everything you do, right, I always believe in this thing. Number one, that is why I call myself an optimistic renegade. You need to be a renegade because you cannot follow set rules. And there's no rule. If you go to anybody right now and say, I want to go from 20 to 350 in 8 months, they'll take a pistol and shoot you in the head. So that it's something that's unheard of.
Yeah.
But for a fact that if you do this, there is a plus point for you and for the rest. The business grows and triples, because at that time, connectivity in a hotel was a selling point. That means you could sell. It's not like nowadays it's free. It's part of the package or anything. It became a commodity where you could sell. You could really make a lot of money. The hotels were making tons of money. Now, for a fact, you're an experienced professional, so am I. PCs at those days were not the easiest things to use. You always needed to depend on somebody over the phone to tell you where to get the connection, how the connection is going to be this. So that is a selling point. So if I could not grow this team, I can't sell my services to the other companies, the other hotels. All right. So this is where it is. So you it's like, you dig in and you start planning and you get your good lieutenants and your majors and your captains coming in. You form a nucleus team, and from there you expand outwards and get that in.
And how was that experience? How was that experience? So you ran this for how long, and then what happened?
Okay, when I just joined them, I was help desk manager. That was my designation. And by the time I finished this successfully, we had grown from 120 hotels, serving 120 hotels, to serving, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 320 to 350 hotels.
Wow.
And this footprint is Asia and Europe and Middle East as well.
Okay.
So that's how it went. And it became really successful, and NTT Docomo came calling and brought them over.
And you left as a help desk manager?
No. After that, I became a customer service director. Then there was a management changeover because the CEO had changed once NTT Docomo bought over. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I was promoted to executive vice president of services. So that's the position I held for, I think, about a year plus, year and a half.
Okay.
Yeah. And
so that's a pretty high position. So why did you leave, and what prompted you to actually move on?
Okay. Now, the higher your perch, the branch becomes very brittle. That's how I take a look at it. Mm-hmm. One of the things that it was pretty up there. It was good. Business was good. Everything was going fine. The boardroom tussles are normal in this kind of positions. My CEO at that time wanted to expand and take over the. We had one major, competitor, and he wanted to take them over. So I did some business study on that, and I went back to him and I said, "Look, you want to take them over because they got full of they're completely cash rich, and he wanted to buy over the company because of the cash." Mm-hmm. But I said, "They are 3 times bigger than us, and they will swallow us. That means all of us here, whatever work we have put in, within 6 months, we won't have what we have right now."
Mm-hmm.
So I said, "Well, it's all about shareholder value, and this is what the shareholders want." Mm-hmm. I said, "I can understand, no problem." So before the takeover took place, I cashed in my chips, and I told him, "I don't want to see the bloodbath. I'd rather go out and do something on my own." And worked out a settlement with the board of directors and left the company.
So you left on principles?
On principles, yeah.
At the height of your career.
Yeah, you have to, because you look at it this way, you know, you don't, number one, what I've put my heart and soul into it, it will be no more. Mm-hmm. But that is business. Okay. That is business. That's how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did not want to see was everything that this team had worked for, because it's just not me, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole team that has worked for being disbanded, and all our hard work and all our IPs and all being just shot to pieces, because the bigger company will just come over and swallow. And that's exactly what happened. Within a year, whatever was InterTouch was no longer there. It was now a brand new company. So lots of the exec VPs, I think we had about 7 or 8 exec VPs. I was the first to exit. And within 6 months, I think all of them exited as well.
So what did you then do if you left at the height of your career based on your principles and your integrity? What did you then do? How did you then rebuild yourself?
Well, now, after learning all this, it's a learning platform, right? One thing's for sure, it's a learning platform.
Mm-hmm.
After learning all this, I said, number one is, how do I share this knowledge I have with the rest? Joining another company, nobody is going to come around and say, "Yeah, Lawrence, come and join us as a VP or exec VP." That's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I became very real, and I said, "No, this is what I'm going to do." I started off my own consultancy just by myself, and started doing training, started doing placement services, because right now, I know where to go and get people, how to get people, how to get effective people. You know,
so you took the plunge. You decided that you were done with the corporate career, and you felt that you had enough experiences. So you took the plunge and decided to venture out on your own. I'd like to understand, how old were you when you did that? What was it? How old were you?
Let's see. At that time when I did that, I guess I was 40. I think that's 46 or 47, I guess.
46, 47. So in today's world, that mm-hmm. would be considered very old in starting a business. If you see a lot of the stories coming out of Silicon Valley, a lot of these entrepreneurial stories, a lot of people okay. who have passed the age of 25 or even 30 are considered old when they're starting a business. So I'd like to understand from you, at the height of your career, coming out and opening up your own business at that age, did it mm-hmm. feel that you were too old, or did it feel like you've got enough experience that this is the time to go out and really ply your trade?
I never felt I was too old. Mm-hmm. I did feel I didn't have enough experience.
Even at 46?
Even, wow. Yeah, even at 46, I felt I did not have any experience. Well, if you take a look at the real stories, the real success stories, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody mm-hmm. makes it. I look, the guys who do it at 25 to 30 or below 25, kudos to them. Great guys. You did it. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. To us, older chaps, more traditional chaps, I guess at 46, I felt I still didn't have enough experience, because here I was dealing with these captains of industry and looking at them going like, wow, look at what they've created. Mm-hmm. And these guys were not 40 or not mm-hmm. 45. These guys were 55, 60, 65. Mm-hmm. And they built a career for 30, 40 years before becoming successful.
Right.
At 50, at 55, some at 60. And what they brought with them to the table was solid experience, solid financial management, very sound judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is where it's at. Okay, I need more, what do you call that, experience in doing this. Because we are in the real world. There's no company backing you. There's no company saying, okay, Lyman Lawrence, this project won't work. Let's drop it. We'll write it off and let's go to the next one. Mm-hmm. You know, if you use that in your own business, you're wrapping up. You don't have anything else already. Mm-hmm. So this showed me that, okay, this is how I need to do it.
Okay.
I did not lean on a certain figure or a certain person as inspiration. Mm-hmm. I drew inspiration for lots and lots of people. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of captains of industry.
So at 46, you started your career as a CEO, a first-time CEO, and you had to figure it out as you go along. So tell us, how was that journey from then till today?
Well, starting off is really, really, painful, because you make mistakes. You assume a lot of things. There's a sense of bravado that comes out when you go out and you meet people. Mm-hmm. And you do the, how do I say this? You do the rookie mistakes, right? You want to impress people by how you, how you are, the outward appearance of who you are. Mm-hmm. One thing I found out was you should never do that, right? You always let your work speak for you.
Okay.
I started going back and thinking about what I used to tell my staff, when I was director, when I was a senior manager, and all my line managers used to come to me and say this and that. I always tell them, stop impressing me. You want to impress me? Just give me the work that you are doing. Do it well. Don't give me 100%. Give me 150%. Mm-hmm. Now, I had forgotten that. So when I went back and I was talking to my new clients, then I realized this: I need to bring this game right onto the table. And this is how I win. Mm-hmm. And it was, painful. First 6 months, it was nothing. First 7 months, it was nothing. Finances were being drained. And slowly, you start getting one project, you get the second project, then you start building your processes and your teaching platforms and your training platforms, and you just go on from there. Mm-hmm. You don't look back. You know, everybody fails at every point of their lives.
Yeah, and let's talk about those failures, because I think we're here in the Renegade Show, and a lot of people listening are at different stages of their life, and right now we are probably in the what's going to be the deepest, longest, or hopefully shortest recession we've ever seen. So talk to me about failures, and then failures mm-hmm. now, potentially in a recessionary environment. How does one handle? Because I think you've been in both, right? You've had failures and you've had to undergo effectively a wartime period. Tell us about that.
Yep. Well, failures comes in many, many ways, right? Failures is, number one is you create your own failure. Mm-hmm. All right. You're too cocky sometimes. You don't follow what is being said. You don't follow the game plan that you put forward. That is your own failure. There are other failures, but which you do not have any control over, like what we're going through right now. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever in their wildest dreams could ever conjure up a situation like what we are in right now. Mm-hmm. You know? So, number one, most importantly, you learn from your failures, what you have done, what was it. You go inside and dissect it and see where exactly did I go wrong. But you must always be careful. Don't spend too much time re-looking at your failures. Mm-hmm. Take a look at what has actually happened and move forward.
Okay.
Right? Do not dwell in where you were before. Take the lessons and move forward. And when you move forward with confidence. Always be optimistic. Now, when we talk about being optimistic, there's so many meanings to that word. Mm-hmm. I take a look at it as a silver lining mm-hmm. on a daily basis.
Hence why you believe you're an optimistic renegade, right?
That's right. You don't need to follow. Sorry, yeah,
Does this silver lining come from? Because I think in order to see a silver lining, especially when your times are hard and the conditions are hard, what is it inside you that gives you faith that there is a silver lining?
Okay. Number one is your own capability and how you see things through your eyes based on your experiences and who you're talking to. Mm-hmm. If you feel like a failure in the morning and you're going to go and see a client, you will never be able to get that deal.
Mm.
So you must work yourself up to a point that you actually know what is the silver lining here. You're going to go and see the, what do you call that, the client in the morning. So you have to work yourself up and say, okay, this is what I'm going to say. You have your game plan, you have this, you have that. And you need to know. Whatever is being said, first you have to listen. What exactly the customer wants. Mm. Then what are you going to bring to the table? If you're not, because that's all you have, right? It's you and your capability and whatever your company is providing right now.
Okay.
If you cannot bring that to the table in a cheerful manner, really, I'm going back to basics, right? In a cheerful mm-hmm. manner, telling people that, you believe me because I can do this. And how do you do this? Because if a demeanor out there, the what do you call, you would have probably spent a little bit of time with this client prior to that and mm-hmm. left an impression. That's why they've called you back for a pitch, right?
Right.
So you work on that. Never at any time feel that you're going to fail here.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a lion's heart. You must always believe in what is going to happen. The silver lining is every time I am going to get this deal.
And how does your religion or your faith instill in you this ability to have optimism? Does it even come and play a part?
Oh, yes, of course. Of course, it does.
Spirituality?
Spirituality is there. Now, I am a person who does not believe in organized religion, so... Mm-hmm. I believe in spirituality. When somebody asks me something, I turn around and say, this is what I believe in. Mm-hmm. And I have a book that I base my beliefs on.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do every morning, who I speak to in the morning, who spiritually that wakes me in the morning, mm-hmm. is who I pay homage to. Mm-hmm. All right?
Okay.
And this relationship, you build this relationship with this higher being, and this is what the higher being and you is not, because the higher being cannot drag you to where you want to go. You must go with the flow. Mm-hmm. All right. So if you come and tell me God didn't help you, the first thing I would probably ask is, did you believe that God is actually going to help you?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people forget that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be a union of two going forward. Because you cannot do it by yourself, and the higher being cannot do it on his own for you. Mm-hmm. He's there. Yeah, yeah. Yes, it takes two to clap. He is there and he wants you to come over and he'll do this for you. He'll open doors or however miracles are made of. He'll get that done for you. But it takes you, us, to go out there and say, yes, I believe, I'm going to do it. That discipline that's instilled in you, that faith that's instilled in you, that's what takes you forward.
And let's talk about us then. So I understand recently that you've joined a fraternity or a society of people. And I think you're holding a position there. Talk to us about the concept of us, the fraternity and the society that you're currently in and you're leading or you're part of.
Okay. The society that you're talking about, the fraternity or you're referring to, is the Freemasons. So okay. I joined as a Freemason 10 years ago. Okay. Now, I joined Freemasonry in Malaysia is huge. It's one of the biggest. There's three portions of Freemasonry, English, Scottish, and Irish. All three are available in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. English is much the biggest one because we are remnants of the English remnants of an English colony. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's where we are. So Malaysian Freemasonry is one of the biggest in the world outside England.
Is it a guild?
It's not a guild. It's not exactly a guild. It's just a pure fraternity. It's a society.
Okay.
Okay. It's a society of men that believe in the teachings of Freemasonry, which has been brought down. Mm-hmm. Lots of people join it. I joined it because I was just very curious. I've heard so much about it, and I said, why not? At the time, I was in Rotary, so I had some Rotary members in my club who are Freemasons. I spoke to them. They told me about it, and they said, okay, fine. You know, I went through a journey of the getting to know them and managed to join them. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, for the first few years, I was not really very active because that's the time I was coming out of my area of comfort into my new found calling. Mm-hmm. Of getting and my own business, getting my own business going, right? Okay. So I, at that time, I was not paying much attention to Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. But as I met a few people who became really good mentors, and they turned around and said, what is supposed to do? How do you actually enjoy Freemasonry? Mm-hmm. And when I started going back in, and I realized, this is what I was looking for. This is how I center myself. Using the teachings that has been given out. Mm-hmm. Now, it's lots of people say many things about Freemasonry. For me, it's a personal journey of discovery.
Okay.
I discovered this through self-discipline and proper guidance. I become myself. I know myself right now. It's a way of life. Yes, you put it. Yes, you've exactly what you're saying. It's a way of life. If you follow the tenets of Freemasonry, it's a way of life. It makes you a better man.
And tell me, how has your life changed once you've embraced the teachings of Freemasonry and developed that new way of life? How have you seen your life changed before you really embraced it and now post embracing that calling or the way of life?
That's a fantastic question, Kellen. Mm-hmm. Prior to this, even though with all my experience before, I was still a hot mess. Mm. Everything was, you know, you're trying to do it 45 things in an hour.
Okay.
You know, so you're a hot mess. You come home, you're completely tired, and you're thinking, did I achieve what I wanted to achieve today? Then the next morning, you're taking a look at it. You have to put on a brave front. You have your drive. Then you go back and turn around and say, okay, how do I do this? How do I do that? What was missing was purpose and how exactly I'm supposed to do it. Now, embracing the teachings of Freemasonry, what has happened was it gave me a way to center myself. It taught me, where do you stand right now? Mm. Okay. The self-realization came in when I started embracing it. Lots of people go into Freemasonry for lots and lots of other things, right? It's now, number one, I must say, it's not a religion. It's not a dogma. It's nothing. Mm-hmm. It is how you perceive it in your own life. Mm-hmm. So that is why when you ask any Freemasons, what is their journey like? you'll find every one of them has a different journey, because that journey is very, very much for them and how they actually discover it.
Interesting.
All right. Yeah. So that kind of centered me and gave me purpose. Okay, how am I supposed to do this? It opened up my eyes and says, okay, and it said, through discipline, hard work, this is how you compartmentalize your day. What you're supposed to do first, you do first. What you're supposed to do second, you do second. What you're supposed to do third, you do third. At that time, I was going, jumbling up everything. Then what happened was when I started compartmentalizing, what am I supposed to do first? What am I supposed to do second? What am I supposed to do third? Then I realized it's just time management. Now, I learned time management when I was like, I took a course and I have a diploma in it, I think when I was 22, 23, and I completely forgot everything about it. Then I realized is when you learn time management at those days, this is how you do it. Drawer A, drawer B, drawer C, drawer D. You know, so you start doing this. Now it kind of says, you know, this is how you're supposed to split your day, how you're actually supposed to do it. How do you become successful? Number one, you don't become successful by helping yourself first. You lift somebody up first.
Okay. So instead of being centered on me, you're centered on we.
Yes, that's correct. You know, so this is where it comes in. Then you realize, right, your struggles are so small. So when your struggles are so small and this person's struggle is so big and you manage to help them, aren't you well equipped to handle your own small struggle?
So has it taught you the importance of service and service to servant leadership effectively? Is that what you've been learning from all of this?
Yes.
Okay.
What I've learned is leadership is servitude.
And that's a very different 180 degree turn from where you came from, right? Having to build everything from yourself, growing up from an F&B to where you were as an executive vice president, and now coming back full circle and understanding that the tenets of leadership is actually servitude. How did that shift and the paradigm shift hit you?
When I finally realized, okay, that leadership is servitude, I was actually very embarrassed for myself. Because it started when I thought about how the mistakes that I've done before. I wouldn't say everything that I've done was a mistake. There were some wins there, but in a whole, I could not see it as success because I was going after the wrong thing. Previously, we had thought about leadership is making sure that everything is done right. You shout your way through, or you bully your way through for everything. Right now, it's the other way around. I serve so I can lead.
Interesting.
It took a little bit of time for me to actually grasp the whole idea. Then I realized, yes, that's it. That is how voluntary organizations actually work. You know, if you look at it this way, right? Rotary, Freemasonry, they're not in the same wavelength, but they have one thing in common. They have charity. Okay. So when you join these organizations, they don't pay you to do anything. Instead, you pay them for your dues, whatever else that you want to do. If you want to do charity, your money comes out first. How do you lead these people when you're not paying them anything?
Yeah. That's a real insight. So as we wrap up this episode, we've seen you go through struggles. We've seen you go through hard times. We even seen you have an insight, a revelation, a paradigm shift, right, from where you were to where you are. What's your wish for all the renegades out there who are struggling and finding their way, and hoping to be able to achieve and understand what you've, I think, found your purpose? What's your wish for them as we end this episode?
Yeah, number one, be optimistic. There's always a silver lining. Always believe in yourself. And the most important thing, never, ever, ever give up.
Yeah.
Seek help when you need it. There's always somebody around to help you. And appreciate that help full-heartedly.
Yeah. Wise words. And with that, thank you for your time, Lawrence. And for the rest of us, be optimistic, and we'll see you the next season. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks. Bye.